Whale. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Please hold your calls, because we're going to have with us this evening one of my favorite guests. His name is Craig Roberts. And Craig was a policeman, worked on the Oklahoma City bombing back in 1995. He was a sniper in Vietnam. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Army when he retired. Now, Craig's read a fascinating, fascinating life. He's also a writer. I've written a number of books. In fact, a number of books we actually carry here at Radio Liberty, including The Medusa File, Kill Zone, A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, and The Dead Witnesses. Two books on the Kennedy assassination, and one sort of an overview of what's going on today. But this evening we're going to be talking about a new book that he's written, or co-written along with General Wheeler, entitled Doorway to Hell, What Really Happened in Somalia. And then we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the other issues that face us today. Do you know that there has been a lawsuit filed against Iraq because of the involvement of Iraq and, of course, some of the Arabs living here, some of the Republic Guard that we brought to America after the Gulf War, who obviously have direct ties to Iraq and the terrorist movement, and their involvement with Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols in the bombing of the Murrah building. You see, everything has been done by the media and by the government to keep you from knowing really the truth about what happened. And everybody is focused on Timothy McVeigh. But a much more important individual was Terry Nichols. And, we'll have Craig on the line, and we'll get him to tell us about Terry Nichols and, of course, the new information that's come out. Hi, Craig. How are you doing? Craig, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much for being with us this evening. And I know it's getting a little bit late back there where you live. But anyway, we were going to talk perhaps the first part of the program about what we have learned, what the new information is on the Oklahoma City bombing, the fact that there's been a conscious effort to cover up the Near East connection, and they've done everything they could to prevent that information coming out. I know that Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney, tried to bring out this material during the trial, and there was no way that either the judge or the prosecution was going to allow the American people to ever learn that there were other people involved. It involved people from the Near East, and of course, there was a direct tie in to people who were tied into Osama bin Laden and Ramzi Yousef, who was the mastermind of the first bomb attempt on the World Trade Center back in 1993. So why don't you sort of pick up the story, because you know a lot more about the Oklahoma City bombing than I do, or most people, because you actually worked on this as a police officer.
Well, I was actually assigned to the case on day three and stayed on it for 6 months in an official capacity, was trying to work with the FBI on it, and then eventually got away from them and started working with four other investigators, and we just stayed on it. We've been on it ever since. We're not done yet. As a lot of people already know, there's been a lawsuit that's been filed in Washington, D.C., in U.S. federal court, against the country of Iraq on behalf of the survivors and victims of the Oklahoma City bombing. And the reason that lawsuit's been filed is we finally were able to convince Judicial Watch and various and sundry people in the Senate and Congress and news media in various places that there is a definite Middle Eastern connection to this. Now, it was interesting that this only happened after the attack on the World Trade Center building that occurred in September. now people were more receptive to listening to the possibility that we did have a Middle Eastern connection to the Oklahoma City bombing as well. It was pretty well covered up back in 1995 and 1996 by the Clinton administration. For some reason, they didn't want anybody to make any ties to the Middle East with this thing. They wanted to have it McVeigh and Nichols and then end of story. Even though all of our eyewitnesses picked out Middle Eastern players with McVeigh in the Ryder truck going to the Murrah building and two that were standing in front of the front door of the Murrah building holding the parking place for the Ryder truck when it showed up. We also had other eyewitnesses that saw people inside the building or in the basement the day before doing what appeared to be wiring explosives to the columns of the building in the underground parking area. We also know that most of the damage that was done to the building occurred in the rear of the building and went down two subfloors. The biggest explosion was actually inside. It wasn't out in the street. So we know that we had devices besides whatever was in the Ryder truck, which really didn't do that much damage on its own. So all of this taken into consideration at the time, we started working the case, looking at the Middle Eastern connection back in April of 1995. And one of the key players on the investigation end of it was actually Janet Davis with Channel 4 in Oklahoma City and some of the people in her news department. They actually got eyewitnesses to identify some of the people that were involved in this that picked photos out of lineups showing a Middle Eastern guy in the truck with McVeigh, who we found out later was an Iraqi soldier. Had been a Republican Guard during the Gulf War. He was identified as one Al-Husani Hussein. He was a lieutenant in the Republican Guards. He's one of the guys that was involved in blowing up all of the oil wells in Kuwait when they pulled out. He was captured and was brought over here along with up to 5,000 other POWs that we had captured during the Gulf War. They were brought over here secretly and illegally by the Madeleine Albright State Department through Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, then scattered all over the country. Now, why they did this, no one knows. We know that the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the Disabled American Veterans and the American Legion at the time all had articles in their magazines. They were all upset about it. They encouraged all of their membership to write their congressmen and senators and find out how come we brought these guys over here. They were the enemy.
And they were not simply draftees to into the army. These were the elite of Saddam Hussein's army, weren't they?
Right. These are specifically Republican Guards. These are the ones that hated us and fought for him. And instantaneously, when they moved over here and were relocated, became overnight terrorist cells. We had over 100 terrorist cells that we know of scattered around the country in various places. We knew that there were two in Oklahoma City. One of these cells had about 12 guys in it. We know who they all are. We have their names. They worked for a guy in Oklahoma City who was a PLO member who was in the real estate business. He would buy houses. These guys would go out and fix them up. They would rent them out, or they would burn them down and claim the insurance, one of the two. And either way, the money went to the PLO in Jerusalem every year or every 6 months. This guy would take a bag of money over there. So we know who these guys were. The problem was we couldn't ever get the FBI to even pick up a single one of them to talk to them because the Justice Department in Washington said there is no Middle Eastern connection, end of story.
Now, weren't there some FBI agents who really would like to have done what they were supposed to, but they just weren't allowed to?
Well, actually, there were a few that really wanted to go after this end. They knew that we were on the right track. But their hands were tied. They were told it was a totally hands-off deal, that there were no Middle Eastern connections, cease all investigations in that direction by order of the highest authority, which is the Clinton White House. I had kind of the wink and the nod, see what you can find out, go after them, do what you can, sick 'em tiger type attitude out of the FBI office here. And so that's why we kind of stayed on the case, and I continued to develop reports and turn them over to my contacts there. Of which, it was, I guess, a kind of a black hole. You put the stuff in, it goes away, you never see anything coming back, you don't know if it did any good or not. But anyway, we continued working the case, and I continued keeping all of my memos and reports and records and files and everything. So when the attorney in Oklahoma City, Mike Johnston, who was working with Judicial Watch to file this lawsuit, actually got the suit filed, they had an investigation team hired, and one of the chief investigators called me and wanted to know if they could access my files. And I said, sure, you can, you know, do what you want to do. And he said, we're really looking at this Middle Eastern connection, the one that goes to the Philippines. And I said, well, that's amazing, because that's the only area I couldn't go, because we had no budget, we had no staff. I couldn't just jump on an airplane and fly to the Philippines and try to figure out why Nichols made so many trips to the Philippines. But we did know that he had gone over there several times. He had several phone calls to Manila and to Cebu City. And Cebu City is the home of international terrorism, especially Middle Eastern terrorism, and for the whole Pacific. And it's a doorway of getting terrorists into the United States. That's where Ramzi Yosef was at, the big World Trade Center bomber guy, who had contracted on a fatwa, which is an irrevocable contract, to Iran to blow up 10 to a dozen American jumbo jets. That was already in the works in 1993. He was tied to the Mujahideen through the Philippines, and the Mujahideen at that time was basically Al-Qaeda, because he was tied into the Mujahideen that was along the Pakistani border, which is the same Afghani-Pakistani Fort Sherman Khyber Pass area that we bombed with B-52s here just a couple of months back. So that was all Al-Qaeda. It was all bin Laden. And at the time, we ran across bin Laden's name, except then he was, I've got him in my notes as Mohammed bin Laden. And it's kind of interesting that we'd run into his name before, and I'd actually written a report on it and sent it forward, and never heard anything back on that as well. So here's Ramzi Yosef. He's in the Philippines. We know that Nichols was making trips to the Philippines. We know that expenses probably ran between $80,000 and $100,000, and he had no job. So who was paying for these trips back and forth? We knew he came back with gold. We knew he was doing something, meeting with people over there, and it wasn't family. Even though he was married to Mary Faye, his wife was Filipino, she was here. And he was still going over there, and he wasn't visiting her family. So where was he going? These are the questions that I put together and packaged up and gave to the FBI at the time, and their deal was hands-off on the Middle Eastern connection, and we had no budget. Well, when this lawsuit started here just recently, now there's a budget, and we actually were able to make contact. The investigators were actually able to make contact with some of the investigators in the Philippines. Some are government, some are newspaper, and so on. And that's when they found out that they had interviewed a lady who was on her deathbed. Her name was Elmina Abdul, and she was the widow of Edwin Angeles. Now, Edwin Angeles, we found out, was one of the co-founders of the Abu Sayyaf group, also known as the ASG, which is a Muslim anti-Filipino government group.
And they're the ones that are actually holding the Burnhams, the American missionaries now.
Right, they have them, but we found out that Edwin Angeles, who was one of the co-founders, is actually a deep cover agent for the Defense Intelligence Group of the Department of National Defense of the Philippines.
Now, basically, then, what you're saying is that here you have this Arab terrorist group, which was actually co-founded by a government agent.
That's right.
Right, and so we have to understand that this is pretty standard. You create the enemy, and then, of course, you fight the enemy. Go ahead.
And you manipulate them any way you want.
Right, and of course, the other thing is, because they have that Abu Sayyaf group over there, then, of course, America is giving them countless millions of dollars to help fight the Abu Sayyaf. And every time they get them cornered, they manage to get away. Isn't that interesting? In fact, there was one instance that was covered in one of the television programs where they had them cornered in the hospital. And boy, they were just going to go and wipe them out. And they went out the back door. What's wrong with this picture? I mean, these are the highly trained Philippine police and military, and they don't bother to surround it. They leave the back door open and they get away. There's something wrong. Anyway, go ahead.
So, Edwin Angeles was one of the co-founders of the Abu Sayyaf group. He was a deep cover agent for the DIG, the Defense Intelligence Group of the Philippine government, and he was captured, quote unquote, by the Philippine Army, and he was taken into one of the hospital wards there, then eventually into the prison. And he finally got to the point to where they were going to allow him to leave and go back to wherever he was before. For whatever reason, this part's real murky. But he said, I don't want to go back. I don't want to leave the prison. If I leave the prison, they'll kill me. They know now that I work for the government. And they ended up shoving him out the door anyway. And it's kind of like working a deal in Mexico. You can't tell who the good guys and the bad guys are, even no matter what the uniforms are. And so as soon as he went out the front door, a guy walked up behind him and put six or seven shots with a .45 automatic in his back and killed him. So what had happened later was his widow was dying in the Baslan Community Hospital in Isabella City, and she was interviewed by a Philippine Manila Times reporter named Dorian Sikat. Now, she knew that she was dying. She was on her deathbed, and she wanted to tell someone about some of the things that had gone on, and you know, with her husband during the previous few years. And one of the things that she brought up was the fact that he and members of his Abu Sayyaf group and members of Al-Qaeda had met in a warehouse near Manila with Terry Nichols, the Oklahoma City bomber. And that with Nichols, and they called him, by the way, his code name was the Farmer. They referred to him as the Farmer, but they knew who he was. And there was another taller American with him. Now, we haven't been able to find out if that was McVeigh or someone else, possibly Nichols' handler or traveling companion or who it was, but they said it was a taller American or a tall American. And she was actually interviewed. They took a transcript of it. They got all the information, and she said that they had talked about building bombs, and that Ramzi Yosef was at this meeting. And this is in 1993. And that 1993, 1994, over that period of time, they instructed Nichols and the tall American on how to build various types of bombs and how to take down a building, which was extremely interesting. So that's basically, you know, where we went with her. And we're working on that case right now, and we've got other names that I don't even know what they all are. If I did, I couldn't divulge them right now anyway, because it's an ongoing case. But that part right there has already been published, and we're right now on the verge of finding out some more things about this. But if you go back and remember when McVeigh went to trial in Denver, Judge Match wouldn't let any of this evidence come forward, even though Stevens Jones had some of this evidence at that time.
In fact, Stephen Jones was given literally an unlimited budget to work up a case to defend Terry Nichols and to defend McVeigh, and he had actually sent people over to the Philippines and come back with not all of the evidence, but much of what you presented here. And then when they had the evidence that showed that this was a much bigger conspiracy than Timothy McVeigh, the judge who had authorized the $14 million wouldn't allow any of the evidence in the court, because then the American people would have found out, and that was the last thing that this federal judge wanted. Obviously, as Stephen Jones, Timothy McVeigh's attorney, said, you know, the most tragic thing about the trial was not the fact that he lost, but that he suddenly realized you couldn't get a fair trial in America. He had always believed you could get a fair trial. And as he said, the judge would not allow the evidence to be brought out. Not on so many things, not just this, but he wouldn't allow Carol Howe to testify about the government having prior knowledge. There was so much evidence that should have been brought out, and of course it was all blocked out.
Jumping back to the Philippines just for a second, and that's true. It was incredible. We couldn't bring any of this evidence to either one of the grand juries, the one that the federal Dog and Pony Show grand jury, or the what we call the Charles Key grand jury, now the state grand jury that was put together later, was totally manipulated by Bob Macy in Oklahoma City, who was the...
he was the district attorney, wasn't he?
District attorney of Oklahoma County at the time. And instead of the grand jury telling him what they needed, he told them what they could do and not do. And consequently, there was only one indictment that came out of the entire facade, and that was... against David Hoffman, who I'd worked with David quite a bit on some of the investigation. David was a good investigative journalist. He's the former editor of the Haight-Ashbury Free Press. He's kind of my left-wing counterpart, so to speak, in some of the investigations. But we get along fine, and he does a lot of good work, and he was just trying to get to the truth like everybody else. And so he had sent copies of his book, Oklahoma City Bombing, The Politics of Terror, to the grand jurors at home to give them more information without thinking that that would give them a chance to get him for jury tampering, even though that he was going to, he could have walked in the courtroom and hand carried him in and passed him out, it would have been okay. But because he sent them to them outside the courtroom, of course they indicted him. He ended up getting community service and stuff like that. It wasn't a huge deal.
But really, what they do is they have a pattern of harassment for anybody that tried to bring the truth out. I know a friend of mine who helped finance some of David Hoffman's work got slapped with a libel suit because of something in Hoffman's book. He'd given Hoffman some money to live while he was doing the research. And so anybody who really tried to bring the truth out was harassed by the government. Now, why would they harass them? You'd think they'd want to get the truth, or maybe they didn't want the American people to know the truth.
Well, the official truth in the Oklahoma City bombing case, like so many of these things, like the official truth on the Amtrak derailment in Arizona and the official truth on TWA-800, that isn't necessarily what actually happened. It's what they wanted the American people to think happened. And they were doing damage control on Oklahoma City. They didn't want it to get out of hand. They pulled in all of the King's horses and all the King's men in the media to point to the militia on day two and day three, which had nothing to do with anything. There was all the investigation in the world showed there was absolutely no so-called militia ties to this thing whatsoever, even over to the Elohim City part. That turned out to be a totally dead-end rabbit run. There was just, everything was so distorted and manipulated out of Washington strictly for damage control that it had nothing to do with the true investigation. The only true investigation that was accomplished were about six of us working on it, Charles Key, myself, Janet Davis, Hoffman, Jimmy Rothstein, two or three others, Hoppy Heidelberg. We worked this thing and followed the actual evidence and the actual clues and versus all of the eyewash that was being put up in the media. So we pretty much stayed on track. We looked at all the rabbit trails too. We looked at the Elohim City thing. We looked at the Kingman, Arizona deal and the Las Vegas and then we found some things that were not mentioned anywhere, such as the drug connections to Mexico that goes to the old Iran-Contra players. Juan Garcia Abrego, who the FBI claimed never existed, and we had information that he had financed part of the bombing with drug money out of Mexico, and he'd sent two bagmen up earlier that month with money from McVeigh and met him in Oklahoma City. We got all this information, and here I went to the FBI with it, and they said that Juan Garcia Abrego doesn't exist. There's no such guy. And then, several months later, they extradite Juan Garcia Abrego out of Mexico on an FBI warrant in Houston for money laundering and drug trafficking. And he turns out to be a big Mexican kingpin down there. And during the time when they told me that this guy didn't exist, he happened to be on their 10 most wanted list on the Internet. So, that shows you something right there.
Well, I think that, don't you think, that they did not want to accept the evidence? Because if they did, then they would have to have turned it over to Stephen Jones for the defense, and they didn't want this to get out. They did not want this information to get any place where the public might be able to learn about it.
Right, and I was working with this investigator that's handling this thing right now about a couple of weeks ago, and the question, and we talked about this on an earlier show, the big question comes up is why? Why don't they want the real bad guys? Why don't they want, you would think that they would love to chase Middle Eastern terrorists around and point fingers at them. Well, one of the reasons is these same guys are the ones the State Department brought in, so therefore, what did the State Department do bringing them in? Why did they settle these terrorists all over the country at that time? Why did they allow this to happen to begin with? Okay, it would have been a political embarrassment, but what else? Is there another motive behind bringing these guys over here? But why Oklahoma City? Of all the buildings in the country, there's no one east of Suez that knows about Oklahoma City. I mean, even when I worked with the British Army in England, I would tell them I was from Oklahoma, and they would go, well, where is that exactly? And I would say, well, it's north of Dallas, and that, they understood basically where that was at, because at that time Dallas was the big TV show in London. But here's these guys over here. They don't know where Oklahoma City is, so how did they pick that place of all the places in the world? We got to have someone who knows where Oklahoma City is, so we need a McVeigh. We need somebody that can say, oh, it's because of Waco. That's why they picked Oklahoma City. Well, if it was because of Waco, they would have picked Dallas or New Orleans. Oklahoma City had very little to do with the Waco case. So I think what it really boils down to is what happened on day one, and what happened on day one is when they shut down all rescue efforts very early in that day, and did so for several hours, moved everybody back away from the building. They pulled in 50 agents with gray jackets on, with no letters on the back, and they emptied boxes of files from out of the Murrah building. Now, we know what they emptied these boxes of files out and put them in two box ambulances and drove off with them, because they didn't realize it, but there was a fireman up on the sixth floor that was stuck up there when they pulled everybody back, so he just waited, and he was still looking for survivors up there. And he saw all this happen. He reported it later. Then later, when people went back to him, and of course we've got this in record, we've got it documented, we've got names and everything, but later we went back to talk to some of these people who saw this, and all of a sudden somebody's got to them and they don't want to talk about it anymore. And they say, I don't remember what I saw, or I didn't see anything. So somebody has frightened them for some reason or other. But whatever was in those files, basically, as I was told by Israeli intelligence, was probably the reason they picked that building. And they wanted to bring the building down on top of the files and destroy them. That didn't happen because not all the charges went off. So the plan B was go and get the files and get them out. Well, you had to move everybody back away from the scene long enough to be able to do that. And here we have it on AP, on the wire service, that this occurred.
Now, Craig, one of the stories that we've heard, and certainly we've seen these video clips that were taken that day. In fact, we have a video we call Cover Up in Oklahoma City, but it shows the television newscast from that day. And basically, they were saying, well, they found the second bomb. They found a third bomb, and they're defusing those. Was there any truth to that?
That was live TV here at the time. I sat in my office at the police department, and I watched as they said, we found another device. And then even Frank Keating, the governor, said, we've recovered a device that is very sophisticated and is going to be able to tell us a lot about the people who made it.
Right. In fact, we have that, incidentally. Any of our listeners, that's a video called Cover Up in Oklahoma City, if they want to see that original film footage. Go ahead.
But I have a piece of the transcript that most people haven't heard yet about this lady in the Philippines being interviewed by this reporter named Sikat, and I just wanted to read just a small short piece of it here so they can get the words exactly as they came out of her mouth, because she died later, and this was her deathbed confession, so to speak. Sikat said, talking about Edward Angeles, said, did he ever talk to you about meetings with Arabs or Americans? And the lady said, yes. Once he had met with some Arabs and Americans in 1994 in Davao City or General Santos City. Sikat asks, did he tell you who they were? She replies, does the name Ramzi Yosef mean anything to you, Mr. Sikat? And Sikat says, Ahmed Hassim, does that mean anything to you? She says, he had met with them and an American who he called Terry or the Farmer and another American whom he did not name. Sikat asks, was the American he named, was that Terry Nichols? And she replies, he did not mention the surname, only Terry. Sikat said, did he tell you why and how many times they had met? She said, they met almost every day for 1 week. They met in an empty bodega warehouse. They talked about buildings and bombings. They mentioned bombing government buildings in San Francisco, St. Louis, and in Oklahoma. The Americans wanted instructions on how to make and explode bombs. He, Edwin, told me that John Jelani was very interested in paying them some much money to explode the buildings. The money was coming from Yusuf and the other Arab, that's Ramzi Yosef. Sikat said, asked, did he tell you when the bombs would explode or when they exploded? He told me that the Americans exploded one bomb in Oklahoma in 1995 after he was arrested and after we first met. Did he ever tell you who was supplying money for the bombing of the building? I mean, who Yosef was working with or for? She said, Mr. Sikat, you are a media man. Do you not know that Yosef was representing Iraq and Saddam Hussein? Do you not know that? Sikat said, did Edwin tell you that? She said, not only Edwin, but others that were close to us before he was killed. One time, a soldier of the Philippine Army and Edwin were talking secretly. I was there because Edwin demanded. The soldier ordered Edwin never to tell anybody about the Iraqis.
We're going to have to interrupt you there. Just hang right onto that thought, and we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to us across the nation or out there in the Great Northwest, we hope that many of you will decide that you want to join the Radio Liberty family. We're trying to get the truth out. If even part of what's said tonight is true, then no man's life or property really are safe. And, of course, so many parts of the story really point to the fact that there are forces working behind the scenes that most people are totally unaware of. And, of course, they tie into the spiritual conspiracy, spiritual movement we often talk about, what the people on the other side refer to as the spiritual hierarchy. In fact, we have a publication we'll offer to anybody free of charge who'd like to get it. It's put out by the Luciferians. Yes, there really are Luciferians in America, and this organization is called the Lucius Trust. They're disciples of Alice Bailey, who was a disciple of Madame Blavatsky, who was a Luciferian, and if you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you'll actually see her quotations about how wonderful Satan was, and Lucifer, really the source of worship, or certainly entitled to worship. So you need to understand that these people know what they're talking about, and they talk about the spiritual hierarchy, the rules of the world, and they have a little pamphlet, and we'll send you free of charge a copy of what they say about who really rules the world. And so as we follow all the trails to try to understand what's going on, we have to find out or have to realize that behind all of this are these dark and sinister forces that answer to no man, but only to the prince of this world. So if you'd like to help us get the truth out about so much of what's going on, and of course what we hope is that it will bring many people to a personal relationship with God, and other people will increase in their faith, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 5 hours every weekday I'm behind a microphone, 2 hours on the weekend. We're on satellite, we're on shortwave, we're on internet. We're just trying to get the message out. I wish we could duplicate our efforts 100 times over, but we do what we can with the support we have, and we appreciate those of you who are members of the Radio Liberty family, and we hope others of you will decide today you want to join. Because if America's lost, there will be no chance ever again to live as free people. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war, because America is under siege today. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Craig Roberts. Now, we carry Craig's book, The Medusa File. We carry certainly his book, Kill Zone, and The Dead Witnesses. And now the new book, which entitled The Doorway to Hell. It's the story of what happened in Somalia, a book that Craig co-wrote along with General Wheeler, who's been a guest on this program in the past. And we'll perhaps cover a little of this as we get to the end of the program. But right now, let's get back more to this deathbed testimony given by the wife of the man who was really a double agent. He was working for Philippine intelligence, organizing and working with the Abu Sayyaf terrorist organization over there. And, of course, he was killed as soon as he was released from the hospital. Why don't you pick up the story there again?
So the lady's name, Elmina Abdul Angeles, was dying in the hospital of cancer. She was giving kind of a deathbed confession. She was talking to Dorian Zumal Zikat, who was a news correspondent for the Manila Times and the Omega News Service. And we talked about the question. It's got down to the part where that Zikat had asked her a question. She said, "Did Edwin tell you that?" Talking about Yosef representing Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And she said, "Not only Edwin, but others that were close to us before he was killed. One time a soldier of the Philippine Army and Edwin were talking secretly. I was there because Edwin demanded it. the soldier ordered Edwin never to tell anybody about the Iraqis. And Seacott asks, did you ever see that soldier before or after that time? And Elmina asks, or says, replies, only two times before, he was the one who would talk to him for information. So evidently the soldier was the contact point between the Philippine Intelligence Service and Seacott when he was undercover, Angeles when he was undercover. He would be coming back and forth asking what's going on. Seacott asks, Mrs. Angeles, do you know who killed your husband, Edwin? And she replies, the ones who used him and then betrayed him, Mr. Seacott. And she says, I want to rest now. And she was growing weaker. And he says, I understand. I'll let you rest now and then talk to you later and so on. Well, he never got a chance to talk to her again after that. She died before he had a chance, which is in March. So that's basically where they're at on the statement as far as the ties in there. Now, when we talk about Ramzi Yosef, when we talk about the Iraqis, it's kind of funny that all of a sudden Yosef is a direct connection to the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen is Al-Qaeda, which is Mohammed Omar bin Laden. And then he's also a direct connection to Saddam Hussein. So now you got Saddam Hussein and bin Laden on the same ticket, which kind of goes along with what was they were talking about in the news in the last day or two about what Bush was saying about there's no plans on his desk at this time to invade Iraq. Now, I don't know what that's supposed to mean. It means, you know, we have no plans, or he has none on his sitting on his desk, or they haven't been formulated, or the military's not ready. I'm not sure, but here we have another situation where Iraq has come up right in the middle of things, where we're looking at them for bioterrorism. We're looking at them for experimenting with the nuclear devices that they may have actually developed something after all, we're finding out, or they may have got something from the Chinese, and if they did, it could be over here. We have over 100 Iraqi terrorist cells in this country as we speak. We now know we can prove in court that they were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. So I think Iraq is something we better keep our eye on.
And, of course, the thing is that there isn't a tie, and that's Iraq and Iran, because even though they've been enemies in the past, I believe that they are working together to some extent anyway on what's going on today. And then, of course, everybody's forgotten who brought the current Iranian government to power. And, of course, we did when we toppled the Shah back in 1979. Who backed Saddam Hussein all during the 1980s? Why, we did. Who backed the Al-Qaeda and the Mujahideen, who, of course, now make up the bulk of the terrorists. And, of course, once again, your tax money at work. Well, you know, where do we go next? You're really going to try to get this into a trial because you want to bring a suit against Iraq. Is that basically it?
What they've decided is that the country of Iraq does not show assets abroad. However, they've got assets all over the world in front companies, and they've identified over 100 front companies just in the United States that are directly owned by the government of Iraq. And what they want to do is be able to lock down any profits, assets, and bank accounts of those front companies on behalf of the victims. But the other thing, of course, is to get the truth out and to force something to happen as far as tracking down and apprehending the people responsible.
Well, you know, what's really so interesting, if this is small task force that you put together, been able to track down 100 Iraqi front organizations here working in the United States, isn't it interesting that the American government, with all of its intelligence agencies and NSA and the CIA and the FBI, they haven't been able to track down these? Or maybe they really aren't trying to track down these Iraqi front organizations. Has that thought crossed your mind?
Well, either that, or they know who they all are, and they're not going to do anything about it.
Right. Well, it's a distinction without a difference.
Right. And, you know...
Because I have no question at all. They know exactly who those people are.
Sure.
And they've allowed them to continue operating and, of course, bringing their profits and perhaps even funding some of those profits back to good old Saddam.
Well, they're all working through American banking system.
Right.
You know, and it's the bank that controls the government, not the other way around. You know, you were talking about who all we funded. We also funded the Northern Alliance.
Right.
And at one time, the Taliban. The problem was, when the Taliban got in, they were kind of like the Iranian students back during the Carter regime. Once they got out of control, we couldn't control any of them anymore. and they took the American embassy. Well, we put the Taliban in, and the first thing they started doing was shutting down the opium and the poppy fields up in northeastern Afghanistan, which were run by the Northern Alliance tribes. Well, that was also run by the CIA. And when we don't have drug running anymore coming out of a certain area, somebody at Langley gets upset.
Now, I think really you might just point out what you're really saying is that the CIA isn't involved in drug smuggling, because that idea to the average American is so foreign. And yet, of course, if they've read Rodney Sitch's book, Drugging of America, got our four tape set, Is There Really a War on Drugs? They would then, or Gary Webb's book, Dark Alliance, or the new book that's just come out now, Into the Buzzsaw. It's so obvious the CIA has always been involved in drugs, haven't they?
Well, ever since the 1950s, after French Indochina fell, and the CIA moved into what at that time was Indochina, later became Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. They just basically took over or retook over the same area that they were running previous to the French coming in after World War II, because during World War II we had the OSS over there. We had an OSS operational team working in the Golden Triangle area whose chief responsibility was drug smuggling and profiteering so that they could support the Kuomintang army under Chiang Kai-shek. And interestingly enough, one of the characters on that team was a guy named Howard Hunt, that later pops up as one of the Watergate figures. But this OSS team was heavily involved in that during World War II. Then at the end of the war, the French came back, took back over French Indochina, but in 1950 to 54, they fought against Ho Chi Minh, who we had backed to fight the Japanese, and the French were in turn defeated, and finally at Dinh Bien Phu, and withdrew out of Indochina, leaving the whole place to subdivide into North and South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Now, at that time, the CIA moves back in, and they start working especially the Laotian area, and by 1960, 61, they've got a big bottling plant in Vientiane, Laos. It's not bottling any soft drinks. Instead, it is producing 100% pure heroin from the opium that's coming out of the northern Laotian area and the Golden Triangle area, and it's all being run by CIA operators. These same guys, when by the time we pulled out of Southeast Asia, they moved to Iran, and they were doing the same thing in the poppy fields in Iran and Afghanistan. Once the Shah fell, they moved from there and they split up, and one of them, one of the key players, went into the Caribbean and started working on setting up different banking complexes to handle drug money laundering, and the other one ended up going into Colombia and working to set up two separate competitive sources of cocaine, and one was the Cali cartel, one was the Medellin cartel, and both of these were being run by CIA. And we found out about this during congressional investigations during the Iran-Contra affair. When we invaded Panama, what we basically did is we took Manuel Noriega out because Noriega got greedy and he was taking more than his share of the drugs coming through the Panamanian Air Force airfield there. And before the planes went on to Costa Rica and on to Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, he was scraping off more than his percentage, and because of that, they took him out. Of course, the excuse was he was a drug lord. But where were all the drugs going?
Sure, and of course, the thing is that when he tried to bring this out at his trial, the judge told him to sit down and be quiet. And so, tragically, ladies and gentlemen, this is the reality, and you can only explain this if you understand there is organized evil. There is good, wonderful people working for our government, but there are evil and corrupt people, too. And unfortunately, they seem to have gravitated into key positions in our intelligence agencies. And the reason you don't hear about this from Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Barbara Walters, is because most of our major media outlets are infiltrated with CIA agents, and they, quite frankly, are afraid to speak out. And when they do, of course, they lose their jobs. And if you don't believe that, we're going to have a guest on here next couple of weeks, who was a producer for CBS who tried to get the truth out on what happened to TWA Flight 800. And she writes her book entitled Into the Buzzsaw. Followed, house searched, as she says, nobody would believe what happened to me just because I tried to get the truth out. And believe me, the people within the media know that if you really try to get the truth out, why that, of course, is the end of your career.
Well, that's exactly what happened when we did the book Legacy of Dishonor, sent it to my agent in New York City. He took it to 10 publishing houses, all of two of which had published several of my books in the past, and he took it to two in Washington, D.C., and none of them would touch it. And then I got a call in the middle of the night one night on a weekend from one of the senior editors, Simon Schuster, and he said, "You've got to get this book out." And I said, "Well, if you like it so well, why don't you take it?" He said, "I can't. I would lose my job." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, and he mentioned the government having control of all of the publishing houses in New York City by placing editors in there, and he insinuated they were CIA. Well, later on I found out there was a deal called Project Mockingbird or Operation Mockingbird, and that's basically what they did. It was official censorship. And so we ended up taking the book and starting a publishing company, dividing the book into two different parts. One of them became Killzone, and the other became The Medusa File. Mm-hmm. And we did get the books out, and they've been doing great ever since, as you know.
Well, we carry both of them here. That's Killzone and The Medusa File. If you haven't read them, why, you might want to call 1-800-544-8927 to find out the suggested donation to get those books. They're must reading for anybody who values freedom.
Well, if you get both books, you end up beating the government at its game, because that was the material they did not want those publishing houses to put out.
Amen to that. Well, we're sort of running out of time here. I just wanted to quickly touch on Doorway to Hell, the latest book that you have written along with or co-authored with General Wheeler. And this is a story of Somalia. It's a story that every American should read, because, of course, we sent our boys truly into hell. Why did we go to hell, send them into that area? Well, it was in large part because of the oil there. There's certainly people starving throughout the world. But we went into Somalia. Well, I'm going to let you tell this story, Craig.
Okay. When General Wheeler was doing the original research for this book, and he was doing it because his son went on both Somalia operations. His son, Brian, is a West Point graduate, class of 90. He was the communications officer for the 43rd Engineer Battalion, which went into Mogadishu during the first operation, then went back for the second operation. And basically, he was privy to all the radio traffic. He was privy to all the message traffic. He saw with his own eyes things going on all over the place. And bottom line was, we should not have been ever put under any kind of UN command. You had a Turkish general running everything. You had Pakistani armor. You had no American armor indigenous to us. We had mainly just troops and Humvees, and it was supposed to have been a humanitarian mission, but when we got there, we found out that the warlords run the place. There was no distribution system. There was very, very little road network. There was no infrastructure whatsoever. It was almost Stone Age. Everything was done by armed gunmen, known as technicals, and warlords had divided the country up. It was a feudal system. And to try to go out and feed people or distribute food was almost impossible, because your convoys would get ambushed and the warlords would steal everything, and to them the food became just like money. It was power. It was everything they could get their hands on and keep and dole out to the people that they liked or the people of their own clans, and let the other one starve, then so much the better. So it was a situation that was almost beyond our control. We tried to do the best that we could. However, during this period of time, we found out that trying to deal with a unified command underneath a foreign command system, with radios didn't talk to other radios, commanders didn't speak the same language, some people wanted to go on missions and others said they wouldn't go, and so on down the line, it was just almost impossible to get anything done. So we started looking at, well, you know, the government didn't seem to be too thrilled about this thing to begin with. It wasn't like we were really trying to kill ourselves and bend over backwards here to do this humanitarian mission. So was there another reason we're in Somalia, of all the places in the world? There's an old kind of rule of thumb when it comes to national interest. If we go someplace overseas to do something, what does it do for us? In other words, if you took that country and threw it into a black hole and it disappeared forever and nothing happened whatsoever, what's our interest in being there? And Somalia is kind of like that. I mean, if you got rid of Somalia tomorrow, how would it impact the average American? Well, it wouldn't at all. but yet we were willing to expend American lives and fortunes over there. Well, we started looking at this, and we found out that there were several things that were actually going on in the background. Somalia has some key points to it that you know, the casual observer wouldn't notice. For one, we found out there was a great deal of oil underneath the sands of Somalia and off coast, offshore. There was a new oil refinery that had been built there near Mogadishu, and it was never put into operation before the Civil War broke out. The entire area is rich in mineral deposits if you know what to go for and where to go. None of this had been tapped. It was totally untapped. Now, that's economically. Strategically, if you look at Somalia, it's on the Horn of Africa, on the east side of Africa, and it juts up to the entrance of the Red Sea, which also controls the approaches to Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Panama Canal from the Indian Ocean. At the very tip of that Horn of Africa, if you hold your left hand up and put your fingers together where your thumb sticks out, imagine that as the part that sticks out on the Horn of Africa. On the very tip of that touches almost Yemen. And Yemen, which is on the south side of Saudi Arabia, Yemen is it's very Islamic terrorist-minded. They've got communists there. They've got terrorists there. They've got terrorist training camps. It's every bit as bad as Afghanistan ever thought about being. A lot of your world terrorist organizations are trained in Yemen. And it's just right there, right next to Somalia. Well, Somalia and Yemen are both Muslim. But on the west side of Somalia, we have Ethiopia, and Ethiopia is basically Christian. It has a heavy Christian population into it, and Somalia and Ethiopia have never gotten along. They've always been at war. There's always border incursions. And if we were going to help somebody, Ethiopia would have been the place that I would have put my money over there. They're very pro-American, and they would help us to go in and straighten out Somalia. I mean, they're just that way. But we didn't do that. So there's another little element of the mystery, so to speak. But what we really found out that was quite interesting is that at the very tip of the Horn of Africa, that province, that entire province in Somalia that's on the tip there, is totally controlled by Al-Qaeda. And there are terrorist training camps there. These people are totally supported by Osama bin Laden and his network and his money. And we didn't do anything about it. And they were there then, and they're still there today. So there's a good possibility we may end up going back to Ethiopia. If we go to Iraq or Ethiopia, I think those two would probably be at the top of the Bush hit list if we send troops over into one of these places again.
Well, let's just briefly tell the story of Black Hawk Down. Now, of course, that was, I think, what, 18 or 15 or 18 hours of the some 9 months or so we were there. But basically, the problem was that our men were sent in with helicopters. They were supposed to land and capture Muhammad Adid's lieutenants and then come out. They didn't realize that there was a trap in many ways, because there were literally thousands of Somali fighters there, and they were intent upon embarrassing America. And, of course, I think the most significant thing is the fact that the Pakistanis, who had the tanks that could have rescued our men, didn't want to send them. They wanted to leave them there to die. Why don't you tell that story? Because I think people have to understand, when our men are under a joint command, why other people are not going to risk their lives to save American soldiers.
Well, you had your Turkish general who was in charge. You had the American task force who sent in the Rangers to capture Mohammed Adid's staff at the Olympic Hotel. And, of course, they went out on the helicopters not realizing that every Somalian down there had an automatic weapon or an RPG rocket launcher, and a lot of them had been trained by Al-Qaeda, and especially on how to shoot down helicopters.
And I think another thing, really most people don't know, if you read Joseph Badansky's book, he says that this was basically a trap, that the Al-Qaeda had wanted to humiliate the Americans. They had set this thing up, and they wanted to get the Americans in and then defeat them and have them force them to leave. So pick up the story there.
Yes, it was going to be the din bin phu, so to speak, something to show that, you know, these third world people running around with AK-47s could beat an American force on a planned mission, which basically that kind of happened in a way that they ended up shooting down a couple of Blackhawks. The Rangers got trapped on No Name Street, and we know basically what that part of the story was. What they didn't show in the movie, and what a lot of people don't know, is that meanwhile back at the base camp, we got the word that our people were trapped. We needed armor to go in there and get them out. Now, Les Aspin, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, or Secretary of State, he had not let American armor be sent to Somalia, even though our commanders wanted armor with us, at least armored personnel carriers, if not M1 Abrams, for convoy protection, if nothing else, or base camp protection. He thought that was just too much, and it was a humanitarian mission, and we didn't want to, you know, use that much gunboat diplomacy, so we'll just leave the tanks at home. Consequently, all we had over there was helicopters and flak jackets, and a few trucks and Humvees. So when our guys got trapped, the only armor that was in the vicinity that was supposed to be within the operational chain of command of the UN forces was the Pakistani Tank Company. And the Pakistanis, who had American M60 tanks that they'd bought from the United States, were sitting there at the base camp, and they refused to roll. And when they got a hold of when the American chain of command got a hold of the UN command, got the Turkish general, he said, those Americans are in there, we're writing them off, they got themselves into this, they can get themselves out, we're not authorizing any rescue, we're not authorizing anything. Well, our people said, we're going in there, we're going to get our guys, and an American captain jumped up on the back of the Pakistani company commander's tank and put a Beretta pistol to his head and said, roll. Either you drive or I'll drive, but we're going out there to get our people. And so, basically, we hijacked the Pakistani tanks at gunpoint and forced them to go in and pull our Rangers out.
Of course, that's the story that they don't tell you here, and the average American has never heard that. Craig, we're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful Memorial Day.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you so much. We could go on for another hour, but we're out of time. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Craig Roberts, and I hope you enjoyed the overview of what's gone on. We do carry that book, Doorway to Hell. We recommend it very strongly. And, of course, this is the time when we have to bid goodbye to the people up there in the Great Northwest. And, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. And so until Monday when we'll be back, this is Dr. Stan. Good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've got a great program coming up this next hour. We're going to tell you about the Ark of Hope. Now, the Ark of Hope is built almost to the same dimensions as the Ark of the Covenant. And whereas the Ark of the Covenant was built out of acacia, the Ark of Hope is built out of sycamore. Of course, this is a pagan wood. This is where the pagans would always celebrate around the sycamore tree. And, of course, the tragedy is most people don't understand that the Ark of Hope now will contain the new Ten Commandments. It's called the Earth Charter. It is designed by Mikhail Gorbachev, former dictator of Russia, and by Stephen Rockefeller, one of the richest men in the world, and by Marie Strong, a multi-billionaire. But we'll tell you more about that. Don't even think about changing the dial. We'll be back here in just a few moments with Barrett Schoes and the Ark of Hope. Well, this is Arthur Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us one of my favorite guests. Her name is Barrett Chose, and Barrett is going to be talking about the Ark of Hope. You have to understand that the people we oppose, the forces, the spiritual forces we oppose, believe in the Bible. They believe that the scriptures are accurate. They just want a 180-degree opposite version of that. And so much of what goes on today is a mimicry of the biblical story, the biblical facts. And, of course, as we move towards the New World Order and the New World Religion, of course, there must be a new Ten Commandments. There must be a new Ark of the Covenant. Only this one is called the Ark of Hope. And it's been built. It's presented now, and I'm going to let Barrett tell you about this incredible mockery of everything that Christians, whether it be Catholic or Protestant, everything that they hold dear. So, Barrett, why don't you just tell our listeners about the Ark of Hope, its significance, its dimensions, its relationship to the original Ark as far as its construction, the pictures that are on it. Just pick up this story and run with it, please.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's just great to be back with you again. And I'm so amazed at the counterfeits that those forces that oppose our God design and come up with, and yet we shouldn't be surprised because since the beginning of time, Satan has done a very clever job of counterfeiting all the good things that God does. But in any case, those who remember the Old Testament tabernacle will remember that in the Holy of Holies, the holiest place in the tabernacle, was the Ark of the Covenant. It held the Ten Commandments, and then it also included the Aaron's rod and a jar of the manna that God miraculously used to feed the people during the 40 years in the wilderness. So it was a very special place where the high priest would enter into one time a year. And again, nobody could ever touch it, see it. It had two rings on each side of this box that the dimensions were about 3.5 feet long and between 2 and 3 feet wide. Two rings on each side. And through those rings were threaded two long rods that were used to carry the ark, again, so that nobody would need to touch the ark itself because it was so holy. It represented the presence of God. God would speak to his people on the mercy seat, which was the lid of that Ark of the Covenant. Now, what is happening is that we're moving closer to having an earth charter. A charter that somehow would represent the spirit and the values of the world in them in a global community where the earth is more important than people.
But now, isn't this really a replacement for the Ten Commandments?
Haven't
some of the people working on this actually talked about how this will replace the Ten
Absolutely.
Commandments? In fact, Mikhail Gorbachev, former director of the Soviet KGB, former president or premier of Russia, former butcher of Afghanistan, he's been intimately involved in writing this, isn't he?
Well, he certainly has. And he said that, quote, "Do not do unto the environment of others what you would want done to your own environment. My hope is that this charter will be a kind of Ten Commandments, a Sermon on the Mount that provides a guide for human behavior toward the environment in the next century." This was quoted in the Los Angeles Times on March 8, 1997. it's the sort of double speak that I've heard him utter at the various Gorbachev Foundation State of the World conferences that usually took place in the fall in San Francisco, and it was moved to New York. But for 4 years, they met in San Francisco, and Gorbachev would talk about, you know, again, he's an avowed communist. He has never renounced communism, but he talks about needing a new unifying global spirituality. And of course, this new spirituality would have to be pantheistic, polytheistic, and monistic. In other words, it would blend together the monistic religions who believe in one God, monotheism, the monotheistic religions, Christianity and Islam. It would blend those who believed in pantheism, which would be generally the earth-centered, the animist religions of the world, and it will blend in all the pantheistic New Age religions all together. And somehow this ark is supposed to represent all of them. And so it's not surprising that he twists God's word just a little bit in order to draw in all those Christians who don't know the Bible very well, and who would hardly notice a difference between what he's saying and what the Bible states. And then the other person, of course, who talks about the Earth Charter and the Ten Commandments is Maurice Strong, who headed up the two UN conferences on environment and development in 1972 and the Rio conference in 92, where they had hoped to introduce the Earth Charter, but they realized that people weren't ready for it. And so they started to work on it in 1992 seriously. Again, Maurice Strong and Robert Mueller and Gorbachev.
And don't forget Stephen Rockefeller.
Stephen Rockefeller. Right. But Maurice Strong says, the real goal of the Earth Charter is that it will, in fact, become like the Ten Commandments. And so considering that this is their goal, what would be more of a fitting occult symbol for this earth-centered religion and the charter that would guide human behavior in the next century than to create an ark that looked just about like the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament? And that's what they've done. It's a little bigger. It's 4 1 inch long instead of 3.5 feet. And it's a little bit wider than the original, but other than that, it looks the same. It has the two rings on each side and a carrying pole threaded through that, and it's on a pilgrimage right now, traveling from city to city in the west, in the east, eastern part of the country, a little bit like the Olympic runners did, trying to rally community support for the Earth Charter and for this wonderful ark that represents all the religions of the world. And indeed it does. It has its four sides are painted with symbols, universal symbols on each side, and also the sides would have four of the basic elements, and the top one would have a fifth basic element. The four sides would have the four directions, north, east, south, and west, and the seasons. So it would, the painted images, the beautiful pictures, the symbols, everything would represent the various symbols that represented occult rituals. For example, many years ago, I attended, when I was writing my book, A Twist of Faith, I wanted to look into feminine spirituality or feminist spirituality. So I went to I looked up in the paper, found various groups from time to time that were celebrating. They would talk like Christians, but they were blending together various individual forms of spirituality. Many other people had attended churches in the past. For example, I went to a couple of Sophia circles and other feminist celebrations, and each one of them, I would watch the women go through the same rituals I had seen Native American shamans lead in UN celebrations, where you look to the north and you invoke the spirit of the north, then the spirit of the east, then the spirit of the south, and the spirit of the west. In other words, these are demonic spirits invited to come into a sacred circle that represents all the four corners of the earth. They would often talk about the colors, And the seasons fit into it as well, and the elements, earth, wind, water, and fire. All those symbols that are represented on this unholy ark.
Now, this is basically all paganism. This is all occult. And, of course, most Americans have no idea the significance of this. Now, let's talk a little bit about the fact that this is made of sycamore wood, very specifically of sycamore wood, not wood, but sycamore wood. What's the significance of the fact that rather than build the Ark of Acacia, which is the original Ark, this one's built of sycamore?
Well, the sycamore tree has a particular occult meaning mythological meaning. For example, it was regarded as a manifestation of the goddesses Nut, Isis, and Hathor in ancient Egypt. It was the abode of Hathor, called the Lady of the Southern Sycamore, referring to the sycamore tree growing to the south of the temple in Memphis. It is often depicted as dispensing food and drink. It has a fruit that looks like the fig, this was considered food for the immortals, the gods and goddesses. To others, it represented mercy, spiritual mercy and compassion. The goddess of the sky is represented in the branches of the sycamore tree. So again, there's a lot of symbolism dating back to ancient times from different cultures, especially in the Middle East, that would make this very significant to those who were building it. It reminds me of how very powerful the whole feminist movement is within the United Nations, and I'm sure that has something to do with it.
But, of course, the feminist movement is tied very closely into Wicca and witchcraft, and not
right.
Everybody feminist is, but there is a very definite tie into that.
In goddess worship. At the various NGO meetings, there's been a lot of emphasis on the various goddesses of the world, and, again, rewriting the faith of women in the world so that it would match the UN vision of a pantheistic and monistic religion.
Now let me just comment that we still have copies of Barrett's book, A Twist of Faith, which is an excellent introduction to this whole idea of the spirituality. It's a twist of faith. In other words, what they're doing is, of course, moving away from Christianity and Bible-based religion into this new religion, which is occultism. And what we've seen in America was, as Barrett has said so often, a move from being a Christian nation to being an atheistic nation or humanistic nation. That was a paradigm shift. But there was a second paradigm shift that has taken place so subtly that most people don't understand it. And that was from atheism and humanism to occultism. And that, of course, is the secret that has been kept so carefully from the Christians of this country. And so many people today talk about, oh, yes, we've gone from Christianity to atheism. No, we've gone from Christianity to atheism into occultism. And that really is the religion of the people who are working behind the scenes today. That is the religion of the people who built the Ark of Hope, who are moving us towards a new world order and a new world religion. And Barrett, it is my understanding that they anticipate that they will get the representatives of the world to accept the Earth Charter as the this new direction for the world at the upcoming meeting of the Earth Summit, which will be held in Johannesburg from the end of August into the early part of September of this year. Have you heard that?
Yes, I have. And I that's their hope, that's their intention, and they may well make it. Especially with the various global crises that we're facing, with the latest UN report that just came out that says that in the next 30 years we had better save the Earth or we can look for destruction. Lots of warning signals that are coming out to scare people into compliance with the new guidelines. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens, but we certainly are going to speak up and warn people. And hopefully, it won't happen that quickly.
Well, of course, all we can do is try to educate people so
yes.
they can educate others. And let me just comment, though, if you have not read the Earth Charter, it is contained within our Sustainable Development Syllabus, which I happen to think is one of the best things available.
Oh,
it actually opens with the background of the American Stonehenge. You didn't know we had a Stonehenge here? Oh, yes, it's back in Elberton, Georgia, if you've never been there. Four great granite blocks where in eight different languages are printed the Ten Commandments that came from the dark side. Nobody knows who put up the money for this. It was built by a man who said his name was R.C. Christian, but that wasn't his name. It was a pseudonym. And, of course, behind this are all sorts of occult significance. Point number one is why, of course, we'll maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature, which doesn't seem to be too bad unless you understand that there are over 6 billion people in the world, and so they're talking about eliminating over 95%. And these people are deadly, deadly, deadly serious. And, of course, this is an occult center. They have naked dancing parties. They have meetings of the witches there. Even UFOs have been seen hovering over the site. And I've been to Elberton. I've gone through all the records there at the library. Fascinating, fascinating story that you're never going to see mentioned in most places because they don't want you to understand that occultism is very, very real. It is so powerful, it's able to conceal its very existence. And so the Sustainable Development has that, and information on the Earth Charter and on the Global Biodiversity Assessment, which is the plan. And we've summarized 1,142 pages in about 40 pages, which is easy reading. And they really tell you that the real enemy of the world is Christianity and monotheistic religions. And of course, the real purpose is shortages of food, because shortages of food are better than abundance. And you read this and you say, these people have to be crazy. But the trouble is, these people control the media, they control the wealth of the world, and they control the United Nations, and they have prepared a new Ark and a new Ten Commandments. So it's 16 commandments in the Earth Charter. This is really an incredible document, isn't it, Barrett?
Yes, it is. It certainly is, and very much emphasizing this new spirituality. And it starts with the statement in the preamble, we stand at a critical moment in Earth's history, a time when humanity must choose its future. And that, of course, is the message that the UN is stressing right now, that if we don't choose our future right now, it's going to be too late. And then it talks about to realize these aspirations. This is after they have cited some of the spiritual goals. We must decide to live with a sense of universal responsibility, identifying ourselves with the whole Earth community as well as our local communities. The spirit of human solidarity and kinship with all life is strengthened when we live with reverence for the mystery of being, gratitude for the gift of life, and humility regarding the human place in nature. What they're doing is taking again all words that sound biblical, and they're twisting it just a little bit so that they move the focus away from God to the earth itself and to the spirit behind earth, which this is a pantheistic force to them, and in everyone, connecting everyone so that we have pantheism and monism. It's a horrendous counterfeit, and it's amazing to see the way that we in our country are not passing through the same cycles that we saw in the Old Testament when the Israelites turned their back to God because he had blessed them, he had provided for them, and in their wealth they no longer saw their need for him, so they rebelled, they ignored his word, rebelled against him, and it didn't take long after they rebelled, which is like humanism, where they were saying, I don't need God, I can make it on my own. What counts is human intelligence, human wisdom, hard work, and so on. And, of course, that's exactly what we've done in this country. And then very quickly you find out you can't make it on your own. You have all kinds of problems, so they turn to other gods, to all the gods around them. Now those people with all those other gods have come to our country, and in the name of unity and oneness, our children are embracing all kinds of other gods in the schools. And, of course, that's part of the spirit and the emphasis behind the Earth Charter, because the UNESCO education system, the global education system, which was promoted through Robert Mueller, a theosophist, World Core Curriculum, lays the foundation for the Earth Charter. And Robert Mueller has been pushing this Earth Charter for a decade right now.
Well, let me just, for our listeners who do not know who Robert Mueller is, he's one of the key players in this whole draconian scenario we're outlining. For almost 30 years, he worked for the United Nations. For a large part of that time, he was the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, and he worked with a number of the Secretary Generals. So he was the number two man in the United Nations for many, many years. Now, Robert Mueller is a disciple of Alice Bailey, and Alice Bailey was a Luciferian. And certainly Robert Mueller is solidly behind all of these things that are going on in the world today as we move away from the Christian worldview towards the pagan, towards the Luciferian worldview. And when you understand that, then you can understand why they're teaching homosexuality is perfectly normal to kindergarten children in California and across the nation. Why sexual immorality is accepted as normal here in once Christian America. It used to be people who lived together without benefit of marriage were said to be living in sin. Now they're just simply living together. And, of course, it's the most normal thing in the world. In the black community, 75% of the children are born out of wedlock. In the white community, 30% of the children are born out of wedlock. We kill a million and a half unborn children every day. It's expedient that let's just get rid of them. Do you think God is going to continue to bless this country when the church has allowed these things to happen? I mean, the Christians are still the majority of this nation. But the church has said, "Oh no, it's all in God's hands." I mean, well, I don't believe that God wants these terrible things happening. I think He's allowing them to happen. I think He's waiting for us to do something, and we're not doing anything. And of course, with this move towards world government comes the loss of freedom, and I believe the massive extermination of large numbers of people throughout the world to get the world population down to 500 million or perhaps even less, if some people want to get it down to 200 million or 100 million. How will that happen? Well, we're being told that just this last week, that was over the weekend, we were told by the vice president, we're certainly going to have lots of terrorists, or there's no way we're going to avoid these terrorist attacks. And then the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, told us, no way to avoid the terrorist attacks. On Wednesday, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, comes out, no way to avoid the terrorist attacks. What do you think they're telling us? Why, there's going to be terrorist attacks here, an awful lot of people are going to die, and so we'll be prepared for it. It's the most normal thing in the world. We have to expect that. And yet, how did all this come about? Well, those of you who listened to our program last hour will remember that we brought many of these terrorists to America. In fact, I did an interview this afternoon with a Michael a Springman, and he actually was working in the embassy, the American embassy over in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And, of course, there were a lot of people who wanted to come in from Saudi Arabia and the United States, come in on visas. His job was to give them visas. And a lot of these people had no business coming in, and he was told to issue them visas by the CIA that was actively bringing people into America for terrorist training. And that's his basic story. And he had actually been there for a number of years and then eventually lost his job because he reported that pressure was being put on to allow terrorists to come into America in the late 1980s. Of course, you're never going to hear this from Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw or Barbara Walters, but behind everything going on today are these spiritual forces that have worked for. As someone wrote, back of all that foes have plotted, back of all the saints have planned, back of the schemes of men and demons, is a higher hidden hand. Well, Barrett, you know, as we talk about this Ark of Hope, about the new Ten Commandments, do you think that the average Christian in America, the average person in America, be they Christian or non-Christian, has any idea of the implications of what's really happening and how this is going to mean the end of America, the end of freedom as we've known it?
I don't think so. Very few people are aware. And what is, I receive so many sad letters from people whose eyes are open. They see what's happening and they try to warn the people in their churches, in their families, in their neighborhood. And nobody wants to listen. In fact, they become, they were originally treated like sensationalists, like extremists. They're rejected for taking a stand, for seeing what's going on, for trying to warn those that they care about. And it's just a sign that what has been going on for almost 100 years now, but especially since the late 30s, mid to late 30s, the transformation of our education system, the kind of brainwashing processes that were put in effect, that were planned, well, back at the forming of the United Nations, for sure, when Julian Huxley became head of UNESCO and the global education, the plan, the global education agenda. And so people have, their minds have been changed. They don't have discernment anymore. And so we're very quickly moving toward the fulfillment of what God warned us in the Old Testament, that if we indeed turn to other gods, we will surely be destroyed. This was stated over and over again in Deuteronomy and through the various prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah. Warning always was, if you turn away from God, God will withdraw his protection and allow the enemies to come over and take your country, take you over. There will be bondage and oppression and famine, all those things. And of course, this is what's happening in America. There's a downward slide, moving away from Christianity and again to the humanistic perspective where we can make it on our own, to the paganism, the new age, the wonderful ideals. People didn't even realize that this was paganism at first because, again, so many of the pagan ideals, so the humanistic ideals were cloaked in Christian words or Christian sentiments. And now we're seeing some of the real horrors and oppressions that come along with that kind of occultism. But, of course, the most threatening danger is this sense of, well, it's the fact that when we turn away from God, we can no longer count on his protection for the nation. But all those people who as individuals trust him will still be hidden in him and can still come to him. And we can, you know, we don't have to be afraid, Dr. Stan. That's what's so wonderful. No matter what happens around us. I think of the scripture, Jeremiah 1:19, where God promises his people that even though they will fight against you, they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you, says the Lord, to deliver you. And that's his promise to us. And we're going to need to take stand on those kinds of promises because the people who have made themselves the new managers of this world order are not, they're not, we know they're not friendly to Christians, but they demonstrate a kind of anger and hostility that we can hardly conceive of because our politicians have always put on a nice front and have, we don't realize what human nature will become. Those people who lived through the Second World War, as my family did in Norway, under the oppression and tyranny of Nazi leaders, saw a little glimpse of it. But we're going to see lots more. May I just share the experience I had with Robert Mueller?
Sure, why don't you go right ahead?
Okay, he was one of the keynote speakers for it was called the Celebration of the Spirit, one of the many individual celebrations honoring the 50th anniversary of the United Nations. This was back in 1995. So he was talking about the Earth Charter. He described the three stages in the history of the United Nations, and he said the first period took up human rights, the UN Charter was for humans, and no one thought of the Earth. Then by 1980, climatologists warned us that the climate might go berserk. Then he said, this is the third period. Now Earth is number one, humanity is number two. Now you must deal with the rights of the planet. There will be an Earth Charter. And then he talked about a letter he received from the International Council on Human Duties. I didn't know there was such a thing, but there has been such a council for quite a long time.
What's the name of it again?
The International Council on Human Duties. Sort of the opposite of the Bill of Rights that we have in this country.
Right. Well, of course, these people have a different agenda. When we get back, of course, we're going to take a 3-minute break. When we get back, we'll invite your calls here at 464-8295 or 1-888 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Barrett Schoss. We're talking about the pagan movement, which is now in complete and working control, not only of our government, of our media, but even in many of our churches where the Christians are being neutralized and, of course, even embracing these concepts of environmentalism. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time, once again, when I have to mention that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help to do what we're doing. We have some amazing opportunities that have just come up, which we cannot take unless we have adequate support. We have an opportunity to go on to 17 radio stations every Saturday. Some of these are major stations across America for, well, really, it's an amazingly small amount of money. Really, I can't even believe what they would be offering those 17 stations to us for. We could do a half-hour program, and it's amazing how many people you can reach with a half-hour program. I enjoy doing hour programs and two-hour programs, but dollar for dollar, the best deal that we've gotten, I think, are our half-hour programs where we reach a large audience. And this would be really massively expand our outreach, but we're not even going to consider this without adequate support. If you're interested in dedicating yourself to this battle of reaching others, joining us as watchmen, because, you know, in Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33, we are called to be the watchmen. We are called to warn others, and, of course, if they don't listen, why, their blood is on their hands, not on ours. If we don't speak out, then their blood is on our hands. And, of course, many people will not want to listen. But other people are listening. We had a lady named Mary last night from Covina call in, and she said she talked to lots of people and they didn't listen. And we encourage her just to keep right on talking to people. Don't stop talking, because that's your obligation. Certainly we want to pray. We want to be prepared for the difficult times that lay ahead. But the major thing we're called to do is to inform others. I got an email just yesterday from a young man who said, I only found out what was going on 3 years ago. I'm so new at this. But thank you so much for what you do. And you'd be amazed at how many emails we get. And we get about 300 emails every couple of days here. And fortunately, my son goes through most of those. But how many people appreciate the message we have, because now they can begin to see things clearly, what's happening. Before that, all they saw was fog surrounding them and haze and mist. And now they can see clearly what's unfolding. And so if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to help us, we have another opportunity to go on and even syndicate our Saturday program. And what a wonderful opportunity to reach people all across America. And I feel that's what I'm called to do, and I hope many of you out there will want to join us in this epic struggle to see if any nation conceived under God can long endure. Can we put off what's going to happen? Well, I think we have to try. I think God expects us to. We've seen time and time again when he prolonged the destruction of societies, when there is truly repentance, and the only way there's going to be repentance is if people understand what's going on. Our job is to do our best, and realizing that in the final analysis, the battle is the Lord's. So if you'd like to either join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or hopefully you'll want to help us with these new outlets that we have had offered to us, and I really can't believe that suddenly we're having the opportunities that we are being given syndicate our program, our Saturday program, on stations across America. But we're not going to move without the support of people who believe in what we're doing. And so if you would like to know more, if you'd like to join either the Radio Liberty family or help us with the items that we're talking about, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is under attack today. Our values, our concepts, our Christian principles are progressively being eroded and replaced with a new spirituality, a new sense of values. And, of course, what has been the mainstay of America is fast fading into a distant vision. And if we do not reverse the process, then one day freedom as you've known it will only be a remembrance of things past. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Barrett Schoss, and our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Now, you will want to go to Barrett's website. And you can come to our website, which is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And there's a link to Barrett's. But Barrett, why don't you tell people how they can go directly to your website and pull down all of these great essays and this information that you've amassed?
Well, thank you. It's crossroad.to. Crossroad is singular. And the T-O stands for Tonga. T like in Tom, O like in Oscar. So it's crossroad.to.
Gee, I didn't know you were Tonganese. No, I'm just joking. Basically, it's certainly one of the areas. It's actually, Tonga apparently is a Christian nation, isn't
that's
it?
That's what I heard. And that the king personally used to, I don't know if he still does, now that Vireo, one of the big servers, took them under their wing. They probably have so many people registered with them. But in the beginning, when it first started up, apparently the Christian king checked to make sure that all the sites that were listed with him were moral and ethical and fit his values.
All right. Now, of course, Barrett has written The Twist of Faith, which we carry. She's written The Brave New Schools, which we carry. And, of course, what was the other book you wrote?
Well, Under the Spell of Mother Earth, Your Child in the New Age, but both of those two are now out of print. Although I still have some copies of one. Maybe you do, too.
Yes, we do. We have The New Child and The New Age, and we'll get those to any of our listeners that if you'd like to get that. If you get Barrett, and if you get Barrett's other things, we'll certainly include one of those for you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-MORE. If you're interested in knowing about them, and certainly you can talk to Mary for a suggested donation. But we feel that this is so vitally important that you have the information, you understand it. And we are called, those people who listen to our program, we feel that probably many of them are called to be in this battle. But you can't go into battle unless you have the full understanding of what the battle is all about, unless you are prepared to discuss this thing in this battle of ideas, and to understand that basically you're not going to get any place by telling people and insisting that they understand. Ask them, learn how to ask questions, learn how to give them lend them an audio tape, and just say, listen to this audio tape and let me know what you think, but I'd like it back in a couple of weeks. And that gives them an obligation to listen to the tape. And who knows, it may impact on their lives. And I believe the one of the most powerful weapons we have is a simple little audio tape. Videos are great, but people have got to sit down and watch them. Books are great, but most people don't have time to read books. They'd rather sit and watch television or have a good time. But there is something out there that will touch everybody's life. And perhaps you can play some part in changing their outlook. And the greatest thing that you can do for an individual is to change their outlook and make them understand what's going on and prepare them for what lies ahead, because those people who don't have a relationship with the Lord, or if you do have a relationship and you don't understand what's happening, why, many times people turn away. Many times faith fails. As we saw in Europe with so many of the people who, during the Second World War, had believed that they had nothing to worry about, that Adolf Hitler was the Antichrist, these were the end times, they were absolutely certain. And of course, today, because the churches had lied to them, because the churches, so many of them, simply went along with the government, why, the churches are empty. And you go into France today, there are far more mosques than there are Christian churches. And in England, in Germany, why, the churches are empty today. An end result of course, what happens when the false religion gets into the Christian church and neutralizes it. And, of course, we're told by Dante, who wrote The Inferno, that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a time of moral crisis, maintained a position of neutrality. And, ladies and gentlemen, we are truly in a position at a time of moral crisis today. Well, let's go to Dave, who's calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing fine. Question or comment?
Well, I have a comment about something that happened today in court in Santa Cruz. They have a new way of kidnapping children. They took a lady's baby from her because she didn't want to have a cesarean section during her vaginal delivery. She claims that that the doctor did not ask her if she wanted a cesarean section, but CPS took her baby from her because they said that she refused the cesarean, which endangered her child. And she came out of the courtroom today out of Judge Yontz, Y-O-N-T-S. She was physically and mentally disturbed completely from the baby not being with her. And they're going to make her wait 2 more weeks before they can make a decision on it.
Well, let me tell you even a worse story. A friend of mine, in fact, John Stormer, a very good friend, told me that back in Missouri, where he lives, there was a man who wanted to help troubled children. So these were kids who were in trouble with the law, came from broken homes. He bought a ranch, and he had these children there. And, of course, under those circumstances, there was a sense of discipline. But the children got a lot of love and training, and a couple of boys were acting up, so he had them shovel manure. And somebody reported him to the child abuse industry, and they came in with a SWAT team and buses, and they dragged these kids out screaming and crying. They didn't want to go. They loved it there. This was the first time they'd ever seen love. And they closed down that place, and they charged that man with crimes that could send him to jail for 20 or 30 years. And the crime, he had two boys shoveling manure. Yeah, we got real problems, Dave, and there's no question. We have injustice, and one of the greatest is justice to the people who are trying to protect children. Yes, occasionally there will be instances where there can be child abuse, but they find child abuse when there is none. And of course, one of the things that can be child abuse, if you won't give your child any vaccines, or you refuse to go along with what you're told to do, that's a great problem. You have anything else you want to say, Dave?
Well, yeah, the obstetrician was named Mums.
All right, well, I don't want to get in personality on that,
okay.
One way or the other.
Well, thank you for letting me talk to it.
Well, thanks so much.
All right.
But we have real problems in our society, I believe that sometimes people, say, well, we know what's best for you, and if you don't do it, why, you're going to be punished. And I think that's a terrible, terrible thing. So I don't know anything what Dave is talking about, but I do know that sometimes the greatest abuse comes not from the parent, but from the child abuse industry.
Oh, absolutely. And it's all, again, part of the design of assuming the control and intimidating the people into compliance, making us so afraid that we're going to do anything wrong that we don't dare discipline our children and make the choices that would offend those who might be watching. It's amazing. I could tell so many stories, Dr. Stan, that are similar to what we just heard. It's happening across the country, and it's just so tragic. It's just, again, one of those examples. In fact, the whole social services department, and I know there are some wonderful people in it. I've met a few people who have been involved, but what we're hearing across the country is that it's been taken over by those who truly hate Christians and Christian morality and everything that we stand for, and as well as the family.
Well, I think what's really so interesting, had this woman who had her child by vaginal birth, had she had a partial birth abortion, had the child killed, it was coming out of the womb, that would have been perfectly all right.
Right.
But because she chose to have the child, now, of course, why they're going to take the child away from her? What sort of madness is this? It's all right to kill the children intrauterine or in the process of delivery, but, of course, if you endanger that child, why, we're going to, of course, punish you. What's wrong with this picture? I have a feeling that we live in a world that's gone mad. There's only a few of us that really are sane, and everybody else thinks we're crazy.
It makes sense when you read through, for example, Romans 1, starting with verse 18, where God just warns us what's going to happen if we turn away from Him to the people. He gives people over. We talked earlier about withdrawing His protection over the land. When a person turns away, there's a yielding of that person over to their lust, their passions, as they slide downward, it says He gave them over to a depraved mind finally. And here's where you have that long list of, they become murderous, jealous, everything evil begins to take those people over, the very worst of human nature without any guidelines. And of course we're moving in that direction because the global paradigm doesn't call for any, the humanist paradigm puts aside absolutes. The global paradigm continues to reject the kind of moral absolutes we learn from the Bible, but they embrace a new set of idealism, and they do indeed have some absolutes, which we mentioned earlier. They were the monism, pantheism, and evolution. Those are the three absolutes that the global, the new worldview calls for. But because they allow sensual freedom and despise the family and family discipline, what we're seeing is just a total chaos, social chaos, which again fits into the plan, doesn't it, Dr. Stan?
It absolutely.
Because when you have social chaos, then people, those people who still have are fairly rational, are going to be calling for political control, government control, in order to have to restore peace and order. And of course, that's where we are right now. We're in a nation that has gone mad. We don't even see common sense, because you don't have the factual basis and rational thinking for common sense. And so there's more, you know, basically people are outside of, who have been part of this process, respond with emotions, with rage and anger and bitterness, rather than with reason and facts and rational arguments. But I wanted to just go through the what happened at that conference when Robert Mueller was speaking.
Yes, please,
because
do.
I think it illustrates what we're talking about. He was talking about needing a rural court and an ethic to condemn any kind of environmental abuse, that some of the evils that had to be done away with were large families, overconsumption, any kind of garbage, religious differences. These were all evils in his mind. And then as he finished, he opened up the floor to questions, and one man asked a question. He said, let's see, in a pluralistic world, would a centralized institution tend to become insensitive to ideas other than its own? Now, that sounds like a rational question, doesn't it?
Right.
And he also said, if the UN becomes involved in spirituality, could it cause church-state violations? Again, another rational question. But Mueller became furious. So did another woman in the audience. She stood up. She sort of jumped up, actually. She was fairly close to where I was sitting. And she shouted in this big auditorium, in Oklahoma, we saw the result of men who hate our central government. Now, this man didn't hate the government. All he did was ask a rational question that questioned a little bit of what Mueller was saying, but he did it very nicely. And in America, we're used to being able to discuss issues and ask questions, but not in the new global society. Any sign of dissent becomes a terrible affront to those who are the new managers. So the woman stormed out, and then Mueller said, showing his incredible intolerance and hatred for American sovereignty and freedom, he said, quote, the U.S. behaves like the first 13 states behaved in the days of Washington. Diversity is beautiful, but these differences can't condone saying, as the U.S. says, I'm right and others are wrong. And then he swore, I won't repeat what he said, and he just kind of rushed off the stage, too, wouldn't answer any more questions. He was done, and he was really, really mad. Now, that's the kind of leadership we're dealing with, and that's what we were hearing a lot about during the Second World War. I was too little to remember what was being said, but you know, I read a lot of material, and again, since I grew up in Norway, and we lived in peace and freedom, it was farthest from our mind. You couldn't imagine losing our freedom overnight as we did to the Nazis. It can happen any time, and the 200 years of freedom in America is an anomaly in the history of time. And right now, the stage is being set for big changes. And I just would say, let's pray. Pray to our God. Pray that He awaken people across the country, that people dare take a stand and face the consequences, which would be the anger of all the people in the country who now demand compliance and consent with a whole new way of seeing.
And, of course, if you speak out of what's going on, you are demonized, you are marginalized,
right.
You are attacked, you're accused of being anti-Semitic, a radical, reactionary, chauvinistic. They have all of these terms that they have designed to influence. And, of course, when you are attacked, well, then you have to go on the defensive if you don't understand how to handle it. But they know how to silence people who are trying to point out what's really going on in the world today. I mean, we see these kids, you know, 16, 17, 18, committing these heinous crimes. Why? because they've never been punished. If a parent tries to punish a child today, slap them, hit them on the rear end or shake them, why, of course, they can be sent to prison for child
and
abuse.
Certainly, children.
If you can imagine a man who has given his life to helping children, facing 20 or 30 years in federal prison because he had a couple of boys shoveling manure. I mean, can you imagine? They charged him with 60 to 90 different charges. This is what they do. They just put all these charges one on top of the other until you either plea bargain or they'll bankrupt you financially. And, of course, this is not justice. Justice is blind. Justice is trying to get to the bottom of things to punish the guilty, not to punish Christians who are trying to do good. And ladies and gentlemen, you're not hearing about this case out here, of course, because they black out the news. It's being covered back in Missouri. In fact, the judge, when he saw the videos of the children being hauled away, you've got these little tiny kids crying and weeping and saying, "Don't take me away from here. I've never known love before." And you've got your guys in your SWAT uniforms, you know, with their vests on and their automatic weapons, dragging these kids away. The judge looked at that, and who was trying the case, and he said, "You wouldn't see this other than in a totalitarian country." And he's actually reduced the charges from 60 to 90 down to 3. And I think the man will be exonerated. Unfortunately, the state attorney general didn't understand that the man he was charging was a multimillionaire who'd given up everything he had because he'd become a Christian. He decided he didn't want to die rich. He wanted to help other human beings and perhaps lead them to the Lord. And so he bought the farm. He financed this himself. He's already put out over $1 million in his defense. And as he said to my friend, "If I have to spend $5 million, I will. But I will win here because I'm right. We did nothing wrong to those boys, and those boys would be better because they've been disciplined." But you see, the devil doesn't want children disciplined.
No.
The devil wants children to do whatever they want to. He wants moral chaos, and that's really what it's all about.
Right.
Do what thou wilt. Do
moral
what thou
chaos.
Wilt.
And from two fronts. First of all, no discipline so that they don't learn to be self-disciplined. They
right.
can't even control their own behavior. And then they saturate their minds with all kinds of occult images through those horrendous occult computer games, movies, everything in our culture that has become a fascination to the children.
And don't forget about the sex, because sex goes right along with this depravity. Sex is a wonderful thing in marriage, but of course they want them outside of marriage. They want them to be hedonistic. This is what happens in every hedonistic society. It's being actively encouraged by the people at every level of our society,
right,
and including the CDC.
Once you're addicted to sexual activity or to a sexual lifestyle, promiscuous lifestyle, it's very hard to turn back, and those people are going to do as Adam and Eve did when they had disobeyed God. They hid from him. And so the kids who enter into that lifestyle, which are Christian kids, as well, I mean, in Christian homes, you know, it's very hard to continue to be a Christian, and which is, of course, one of the reasons then that the churches are compromising and saying, you know, forget the guidelines. Just, you know, God loves you no matter what. And so we distort the church in order to adapt, to create a culture that the kids will come to with their immoral lifestyle. It's just amazing how you can see the ripples from the pebble just get wider and wider, embracing the church, the family, everyone in this incredible social revolution that's taking place around the world right now.
And of course, we never talk about a God of justice or a God of judgment or God of punishment or a God of vengeance or a God of wrath. Oh, no, that's not the God that we worship. We worship only a God of love. Well, if God is only love, then it is the ultimate triumph of evil.
Right, and there's no need for the cross,
no need for
repentance, and there will not be any genuine Christianity.
That's right, and that's what they've done. They've changed the message, they've changed the theology of the church.
Yes.
And of course, that's exactly what the enemies of Christianity have always wanted to do. And now these people are in positions of power, and we find multi-billionaires, and that would be, of course, Maurice Strong and Stephen Rockefeller, to mention two, but there are many, many more. And of course, they're all embracing this occult religious belief, the Earth Charter of the New World Religion.
Just a reminder of that what's happening right now isn't an unusual event in the history of time. Satan keeps repeating his tactics and his way of fighting the battles. In Isaiah 5:20, for example, it says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, but light for darkness and darkness for light. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight." And in response, you know, to what's happening, God reminds us that he will not be mocked. We had better follow him. And it's going to be costly because the new society is implementing all kinds of controls to keep people in shape, to keep them from turning against or exposing what's going on. And we don't see the result yet, but I believe we will more and more very quickly. And then we need to remember that Jesus said that if they persecute me, they will persecute you because they do not know the one who sent me.
Well, we're living in difficult times. We're living in exciting times when you have a personal relationship with the Lord. And for the people who do not have a personal relationship with the Lord, what lies ahead will be terribly frightening. But let me mention a Bible verse. It's Malachi, the fourth chapter, verses 1-4. And read those, because if you know the Lord, why, we'll get through this one way or the other. You know, we may be taken home. Or if we are left behind, why, the Lord will give us the strength to persevere. And if you don't have that belief, if you don't have that confidence, then, of course, when times get difficult, why, of course, people become chaotic, they become fearful, they simply crumble and they give up. They have nothing to believe in. But, of course, we do. Barrett, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, again, the scripture, he tells us, "I will never leave you or forsake you." And so, again, we can be confident that he is our helper. We don't need to be afraid. What can man do to me, it says in Hebrews 13:5. Come to our website and see how to put on the armor for times like this. Read the section on persecution, the stories for children, so you can prepare your children. And then read the section on preparing for victory, because God has given us so many wonderful promises and so many scriptures that will enable us to be joyful and walk in peace in his triumph, to be more than conquerors no matter what happens.
And remember that website, it's crossroad.to. That's crossroad.to. And just to be thankful that we still have a voice, we still can reach out, and hopefully we'll be reaching out to increasing numbers of people. God bless you, Barrett. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, well, that was Barrett Schoss, and certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope one of yours as well. And go to her website. She has done some wonderful, wonderful work, written some wonderful essays, and it's always a pleasure to have her with us here. We're involved in the spiritual battle for the hearts and souls of mankind. And, of course, where do you stand? Are you joining with us in this battle? Or are you simply going to sit on the sidelines and watch and see it unfold? Because if things go as we anticipate, of course, eventually you're going to have to be on one side or another. There will be no neutral ground. So we ask you to pray for America, and that's so important. And then we ask you to pray for our leaders, and we ask you to pray for our ministers. Pray for revival, that God's Spirit will move across this land again, that did in the 1700s of the first great revival, in the mid-1800s of the second great revival. We need a third great awakening here in America. And that's why we do what we do, hoping that perhaps some spark of what we say may begin to light that great revival that's needed here. Until Monday at the same time, we'll be back with you on Monday evening. This is Dr. Stan. Good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.